Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Allison. So lots has happened since our last show. And here we are now in the middle of a campaign for legislative elections. I wasn't planning on that.
No, that was supposed to be 3 years away.
Exactly.
But President Emmanuel Macron dissolved parliament after recent European elections in which the far-right National Rally made historic gains. They got over 30% of the vote.
And if they do equally well in these elections, so on June 30th and July 7th, there's a good chance that France will have a national rally far-right prime minister, Jordan Bardella. He took over the party from Marine Le Pen.
Yeah, of course, nothing is set in stone for the moment. Yeah. There is still a lot of political jockeying going on, you can imagine, with alliances and not alliances.
Yeah, the left has created an alliance of its own, the Nouveau Front Populaire, New Popular Front. This is between the hard left, France Unbowed, the socialists, the greens, communists, all this to challenge the far right.
And the head of the conservative mainstream right-wing party, the Républicains, has formed an alliance with the National Rally. But of course, not everyone far from it in his party agrees.
Yeah, so that's a bit of a mess. And then Macron's party has been quietly making its own alliances. For example, not running candidates in about 70 constituencies in favor of the conservative candidate or the centrist candidate. So a group needs 289 seats to get an outright majority in the National Assembly, which has 577 seats total.
And for the moment, the RN has 89.
Yeah, and based on the percentage it won during the European elections, it could win about 182. For context, Macron's party currently has 245 and still lacks a ruling majority.
Yeah, but of course, these are very different elections, aren't they, Sarah? Yeah. They're very local, lots of local issues, and there is a lot at stake. So maybe turnout will be a lot higher.
Yeah, and different people coming out to vote. Polling really gives us no clear idea of what will happen. So the polls show a range anywhere for the national rally from 100 to 280 seats.
Yeah.
On that high end, if they get some key alliances, Bardella could well become prime minister with a majority. And this worries a lot of people on the left, on the center, and on the right.
Yeah, because this would be the first time that the far right finally gets into power if it does happen. And the prime minister does have a lot of power, even with this weird double-headed governance thing we have in France.
Yeah. So Macron will remain president until 2027. He's not stepping down yet. But if he can't win a parliamentary majority, which he wasn't able to do in 2022, he'll more than likely end up in this situation of cohabitation, governing with a prime minister from a rival faction.
Of course, that could also be somebody from the left, depending on how these elections go.
True. Who knows? But whoever wins would have a lot of power over what happens in France. So the Constitution says the prime minister directs the action of the government and the policy of the nation. He or she appoints the government and the president just rubber stamps. But it's not just a parliamentary system. The president does remain, you know, the president has quite a lot of power in France. But, you know, who knows? The national rally, if it wins an outright majority and Bardella becomes prime minister, though, the big question is, what will that mean for France? The RN is very concerned with security and immigration. Surveys show that immigration is the primary concern for RN voters.
Nous arrivons à un point de non-retour en termes d'immigration. Nous accueillons chaque année près
We're coming to a point of no return in terms of immigration. That's RN spokesperson and MP Julien Odoul speaking to RFI last week. France, he says, cannot today deport delinquent immigrants or those who've committed crimes, and that has to change. Plus, he said, France already has too many poor and unemployed people.
Nous ne pouvons plus accueillir une immigration qui aujourd'hui principalement est au chômage.
We cannot continue with an immigration that today is principally made up of unemployed people and those on welfare, he said. The National Rally wants to bring back wiggle room, as he calls it, and to do so, France needs to shut its doors to immigration. Cutting immigration is actually a key part of the party's economic policy, or what we can piece together of it.
As we're recording, the National Rally hasn't put out a really official economic platform.
Yeah. Bardella has given a few interviews that indicate some of what he might do economically as prime minister. He said, for example, that he would immediately get a law passed to reduce VAT on fuel, though he didn't say how he'd cover the budget deficit from that move. And then he said he'd undertake an audit of the government's finances, kind of buying himself time. And based on that, he said he would decide other policies. So what we can piece together of the economic direction of the national rally comes from material mostly from Marine Le Pen's 2022 presidential race. That platform promoted the idea of national preference, so stripping foreigners of the right to social benefits and then using that money to fund more things for French people. Romeric Godin, who writes on macroeconomic issues for Mediapart, the leftist investigative website, says the national rally started shifting towards more social economic policies in the 2010s and 2020s, taking on the question of retirement, for example.
Yeah, they promised to reduce the retirement age back to 60 for everyone, though they've since backtracked on that.
Yeah. And Pardella said that revisiting the retirement reform might happen, but later in the year. Mm. Now, some have called the National Rally's economic proposals leftist because they're focused on redistribution. But Godin says this isn't quite the correct interpretation.
They insist on redistribution, but they make the redistribution by what they call the préférence nationale, or national preference. It's a redistribution, ethnic and national criteria, which is a discriminatory policy. It's not a redistribution from the richer to the poorer via tax increases or via state policy in the economy. It's very different from a left platform, even from a center-left platform. It's really a far-right economic policy.
So they're promising an alternative to what we have now. I guess all the opposition parties are doing that. Would it actually be an alternative to what exists in France today?
For me, it's more a way to go on the current policy, but on different bases. What Bardella prepares France to is to an austerity policy. And the current government has already promised an austerity policy for 2025 and 2026. So there is no difference because they say public finance is in disarray. So for the national rally, the difference with the Macron experiment is that what they say is we can make this austerity, we can implement this austerity, but with the national preference. And so the austerity will be harder for the foreigners and not for the French. So we can see that in the fact, two options. The first option is that they continue the austerity policy, the Macron policy, the neoliberal policy, but politically they insist on security, repression of the migrants, and they make a very right-wing policy on other issues in order to make the people forget that they don't have the redistribution they promise. Or we have this policy of discrimination, of economic discrimination, in order to finance the promises they made to the French people. The difficulty is that this discriminatory policy is against the French constitution, against the EU pattern. So it will be very, very difficult to implement in the today's legal frame.
Why is the national rally, I mean, why is it so attractive economically? Like, what can be very attractive to people who, say, may not otherwise have voted for a far-right party before?
You know, it's very clear. We had, since 2017, a very neoliberal policy with Macron. They made reforms, structural reforms. They implement a neoliberal agenda very heavily for France. I speak from the French point of view. I know that it's not the US or...
yeah, it's all relative.
Yeah, and it's... In reality, it doesn't work. The current situation, in particular of the households' revenue, is very bad. Real wages are down in 2023, and the situation of some regions in France are very, very bad. So there is this feeling that this policy doesn't work. In front of that, you have the left-wing proposal, but many people in the worker class in particular say that the left-wing have always left the people in the field and has made some neoliberal policies themselves.
Yeah, there's a real disappointment with the left.
Yeah, the left that says we could make the rich poorer in order to make the poor richer is not really credible in the eye of a lot of people in France today. So when you reject Macron and you don't trust the left, the alternative will be the far-right party. And I think that this kind of redistribution of ethnic and national redistribution is very attractive for some people that think that it is a solution to their problem. And that's a great success of the National Rally to make these people think that, in fact, make the foreigner poorer will make them richer.
So the other big question for what might happen with a National Rally government concerns foreign policy, mm-hmm. France's relationship with the rest of the world. This is important.
Yeah. And the constitution isn't that clear about who's responsible between the president and the prime minister. So the president is the chief of the army. The president's responsible for negotiating treaties, but the prime minister is responsible for national defense, and the government administers the armed forces. So it's kind of a shared responsibility mm-hmm. there, true cohabitation. An RN parliament and prime minister would very much impact how France interacts with the rest of the world. The National Rally is overtly nationalist. They support a more independent French foreign policy, though it has moved away from being overtly Eurosceptic. It would like to see a reform of the EU and France leaving the NATO command. For Nicolas Tenzier, who teaches political philosophy at Paris's Sciences Po Foreign Policy School, the National Rally would tarnish France's image in the world.
It is absolutely clear that this would be a disaster for France because it would lose its credibility and its status. It's also easy to imagine that the intelligence services in most other countries would hesitate, and rightly so, I would say, to share a certain amount of sensitive information with France. So we must not underestimate the catastrophe that would hit the country.
And of course, the ongoing war in Ukraine is a concern. Nicolas Tenzier says the National Rally has never been supportive of Ukraine, even if the rhetoric is softened recently. The voting record tells another story.
The National Rally, whether in France or European Parliament, has never voted for a single resolution in favor of Ukraine, nor for any resolution clearly condemning Russian aggression and war crimes. That's the reality. If National Rally MPs were to win a majority in the National Assembly, they could block any budget in support of Ukraine. In practical terms, this means that Ukraine would be completely sacrificed.
And then there's the environment. Activists worry about an RN government, given that its policies are very much anti-renewable energy and pro-nuclear. Here's Arnaud Schwartz, the vice president of the France Nature Environnement NGO.
It's a party that is relatively climato-sceptique, même si il va pas forcément l'affirmer comme ça.
It's a relatively climate-skeptic party, he says, even if they don't always say it that way. They'd like to stop deploying renewable energy, even though it's the least expensive out there. Instead, the party has said it wants to develop France's hydroelectric capacities and nuclear and invest in hydrogen. Schwartz is skeptical.
Et là, on aurait de graves problèmes, même pour notre industrie. On a besoin pour la transition.
This would be a big problem even for our industry, he says. To transition away from fossil fuels, we need renewables. He says the National Rally is lying by saying that nuclear can replace solar and wind production. It takes dozens of years to build nuclear reactors.
Of course, Macron has also backed on nuclear energy, hasn't he, Sarah?
Yeah, but he hasn't called for halting solar and wind power generation. Now, it has to be said that in general, the National Rally program isn't all that developed. So most of what we have is based on Le Pen's 2022 presidential election campaign. On the back of that, there's also the question of whether the RN has the capacity to govern the country. They say they can. They've been building up a group of professionals over the past decade, a few hundred people who could work in ministries and have been working on a kind of shadow government.
Whatever happens after the second round of the vote on July the 7th, Macron won't have an easy ride, huh?
No.
He will unlikely get a majority or even a ruling coalition.
Yeah, and cohabitation is no fun. Of course, it also depends on who it's with. And I guess if it all goes badly for Macron, he does retain the right to dissolve parliament again, though he needs to wait another year.
Je suis le dauphin de la place Dauphine et la place Blanche à mauvaise mine. Les camions sont pleins de lait, les balayeurs sont pleins de balais. Il est 5 heures, Paris s'éveille. Paris s'éveille.
je dissous aujourd'hui l'Assemblée nationale.
That's Charles de Gaulle, the first president of the Fifth Republic, announcing that he was dissolving Parliament. That was back in 1968.
Yeah, Macron isn't the first president to do this. It's happened five times in the past 60 years or so.
And that's what Jess Phelan's been looking into. Hi, Jess.
Hello. Yeah, that's right. The National Assembly has been dissolved before, but it is unusual, and especially lately. So the first time was in 1962, just 4 years after France had adopted the constitution that it still has today. That was in 1958. So under that constitution, France's president wasn't directly elected, and Charles de Gaulle wanted to change that. But Parliament wasn't on board, so he dissolved it, put it to a vote, which he won. He got a majority and the reform went through.
So far, so good. And then de Gaulle did it again 6 years later in 1968.
In May 1968, which is a very tumultuous time for France.
Right. The height of the May 68 protests, started by students, joined by workers. Mm-hmm. It was one of France's biggest ever protest movements.
La France, en effet, est menacée de dictature.
So that's de Gaulle saying that France is threatened by dictatorship from the protesters who he said wanted to overthrow the country's institutions without a vote. And that included him, by the way. So instead, he promised people the chance to vote for a new parliament, just like the constitution said he could. And that way he made himself out as the voice of democracy and due process, standing up to these violent protesters.
So, of course, he was duty-bound to stay on as president. That was a neat argument, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it paid off. The so-called silent majority turned out for de Gaulle, and his supporters won parliament by a landslide.
And he resigned the next year, though.
Yeah, right.
So maybe that didn't go so well for him. Who was the next president to dissolve parliament?
Well, fast forward to May 1981. François Mitterrand had just been elected France's first left-wing president in more than 20 years. But the parliament he had to work with was dominated by conservatives, and that might have got in the way of all the reforms he was planning to make. So he called snap elections right after he was inaugurated, which his party won handily.
And then he did it again in 1988.
Yeah, so this is to do with the electoral cycle in France at the time. Parliamentary elections weren't held on the same schedule as presidential elections. MPs were elected for 5 years and the president was elected for seven. There was this 2 year gap in between them. So France had elected a right-wing parliament in 1986, then re-elected Mitterrand, a left-wing president, in 1988. So he tried to reset the balance again by calling snap elections, except that this time it didn't go in his favour. His socialist party ended up ruling without a majority, struggling to get bills through this divided parliament.
Which is kind of what President Macron is doing today, right? Ruling by minority, often by decree or using different constitutional tools, it makes sense to want to try and get a majority.
Yeah, it does. But as Mitterrand's attempt showed, it doesn't always work out. And the other cautionary tale is Jacques Chirac, who was elected president in 1995. And when he took office, his conservatives had a huge majority in parliament. But they made some unpopular cuts to the welfare system. They ended up facing massive protests. The party's popularity was plummeting, the economic forecast wasn't good, and the National Assembly was up for re-election in 1998. So Chirac decided to take a gamble. He called early elections in spring 1997.
Aujourd'hui, je considère en conscience que l'intérêt du pays commande d'anticiper les élections.
So I believe it's in the best interest of the country, he says there as he was announcing it on TV.
And in his own interest too, right? He didn't want his party's popularity to fall even lower before the official vote.
And that's exactly what people criticized him for. So until then, every time a president had done this, there'd been some sort of major crisis, whether a social one or political. But Chirac's own party was in charge of parliament at the time. It's not like he couldn't work with them. He was basically playing politics.
So how did that go for him in the end?
Well, really badly. The right lost this big majority and Chirac ended up cohabiting with a left-wing prime minister for the next 5 years. It's gone down in history since as one of the worst miscalculations in modern French politics.
So is that why maybe no other president has tried it since?
Well, it definitely showed the risks. But France also changed its election schedule so that since 2002, the president and the parliament both get five-year terms. And both of those elections are held in the same year. And that makes cohabitation between different factions less likely, although that's exactly where Macron might end up after this.
So France may be on the brink of a political crisis, if it isn't already in one, but, you know, life does go on. And it's Paris Fashion Week. Girls excited about that?
I usually manage to ignore most of it, I have to say.
I don't think I even knew it was Fashion Week.
Me neither.
Well, that's kind of my own take on things too. To be honest, you know, if the hem is up or down, if grey is the new black or black the new navy, it's all the same to me, really. I'll take whatever the thrift store has to offer. But I have to say, when fashion rhymes with social history and feminism, I perk up a bit.
When I discovered the name of Jenny Sacerdot and all her career, I was in my feminism period, and I wanted to defend the rights of women and put a spotlight on strong French women. Yeah. Women who didn't receive the spotlight she deserved. Her clothes helped women to be free and to feel free.
That's Anne Vogt. She's a stylist and fashion historian, author of a biography on Jenny Sacerdot. Have you heard of her?
Never.
No.
Okay. Well, neither had I. And yet, it turns out that she was one of France's top haute couture designers in the 1920s and 30s, just as famous in France and abroad as Coco Chanel. The Americans loved her. They called her Jenny, and she kept that name. She was actually born Jeanne Adèle Bernard, out of wedlock, in Périgueux in southwest France. Her mother and grandmother worked in the garment industry, and she followed in their footsteps. But a lot later in life, she was 39 when she got into it. She had talent, tenacity, and a good business brain. She opened her first shop in Rue Castiglione, near Place de la Concorde in Paris, on the 18th of June, 1909.
So 115 years ago this week.
And bit by bit, she built up a fashion empire. She employed 1,000 young female garment workers. They were known as midinettes. And she clothed some very important people, the Empress of Japan, Queen of Egypt, Fred Astaire's mother and sister, the silent film actress Mary Pickford, not to mention loads of French stars, even sports personalities like the top tennis player Suzanne Lenglen. But after World War II, she more or less fell into oblivion, and no one here in France talks much about her anymore. For Anne Vogt, this is an injustice that deserves to be corrected. Anne delved into the archives to dig out Jenny's designs. There were at least 800 of them, sometimes just drawings, but with a load of explanations to accompany that. And Vogt has brought them back to life via her own trademark, La Suite de Jenny Sacerdot, Jenny Sacerdot Chapter 2, if you like. She's used her original designs, sometimes making the odd modification. Some of them were on the catwalk this week as part of a fashion show by the French Federation of Made-to-Measure Couture in a Paris hotel, and I chatted to her there.
Every model is a real model created by Jenny Sacerdot in the 20s and 30s, and they are replicated like they were at the time.
The first one is a kind of pale green.
In green with the coat. It's called Foxtrot. This dress was created to dance Foxtrot during the 20s.
And the second one is this beautiful deep pink flowing dress.
Yeah, this one is called Ruchette, and it comes from 1924. This one, yes, is in pink, and Jenny Sacerdot really liked pink. It was her favorite color.
Yeah, it's a really deep fuchsia, a strong color.
A strong color, like a strong woman, as she was.
You yourself are also wearing a dress designed by Jenny Sacerdote, is that right?
Yes, this one was designed in 1918 during World War One. It's gold with lovely sleeves, giant sleeves. She was really well known for sleeves and also for collars. One of the first things she invented is the col bateau.
A boat neckline.
Yes.
It became very popular.
And the other thing she worked on a lot is the back.
The back of the dress.
Yes. Sometimes the front was really simple. And when the lady turned, we could, wow, saw something very spectacular. She created only one single sur mesure piece for her client. She was really, really focused on the personality of the client.
What is so inspiring about her fashion?
Every clothes is really comfortable because it's free, because we can move. Jenny Sacerdote wanted to liberate the body of women. So she created very fluid clothes, very fluid dresses. It's also very glamorous because you can see the shape, the body. And she used a lot of silk because it's a fluid material. You can feel it on your skin. It's absolutely divine.
Anne Vogt wasn't just inspired by Sacerdote's approach to dressing women of the time. She was also impressed by her entrepreneurship.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
Vogt sells her collection in a shop in Paris with other female stylists that are making one-off eco-friendly pieces. And there she told me about the rise of the House of Jenny and its 1,000 midinettes.
She started very early in 1909. She created something new. She simplified the lines, simplifying the garments, the dress, the suits. She was really inspired by geometry. And then she was so famous that she decided to move from Rue de Castiglione, where she has her first boutique, to Champs-Élysées, where she had two entire buildings, 22 workshops, 1,000 midinettes. And
this was in 1914, so this was at the beginning of the First World War.
Yes.
There she was, building up a fashion empire at a time when, you can imagine, France was beginning to be in crisis, Europe was in crisis. How did she survive?
She was really creative at that time. She decided to maintain the 1,000 people who were working for her. So she decided to target countries where...
They weren't at war.
Yes. And she sent drawings to dealers in America, in England, in Spain, in Australia, in Japan, wherever war didn't exist. People in America, for example, they could recreate the garment exactly as she wanted. So
she became hugely popular in the States.
Yes, and she was so creative and so dynamic that she could sell one drawing to 16 different dealers.
So in fact, she was also a very good businesswoman.
Yes, because at that time, the society was managed by the Napoleonic Code. It means that, roughly speaking, women couldn't do anything. And at that time, she decided to open a house. And she was really the entrepreneurship woman. She put money, she gathered bankers to support her. And she was really the businesswoman who wanted to manage her business. She was the one who decided things.
But she did get some investment, though, didn't she, via her husband, Achille Sacerdote, who was a wealthy man?
She had to convince her husband, and also she had the support of her brother-in-law, Paul Sacerdote. He was a scientist, and he had a good mindset.
I know there was, for example, a big strike in 1917,
in France, a lot of especially manual workers were putting down tools. And of course, she was employing a lot of these women. How did she navigate that period in French society?
It was really complicated because it was World War I, and because the economic situation was going badly. Mm-hmm. There was a rumor that wages were about to decrease, mm-hmm. and the women were really, really worried. That's why they decided to go on strike. At the very first time, Jenny was really surprised because when she arrived in her house, she saw nobody. When the second shift arrived, nobody came, neither. And then she had a call from one of the midinets saying, we want a better salary, or we don't want to stop working during the weekend. Well, it was a very complicated time because Jenny had to deal with the Fédération de la Couture Parisienne and to deal with the Ministry of the Industry and blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, she got the two things.
She maintained their salary.
Yes.
And she continued to employ them at weekends.
Yes.
Because at the time, people were interested in working at weekends as well. At the time, you didn't get paid leave.
Yeah.
She was already, in a way, defending workers' rights.
And she did that all her time. She was a really, really good manager. She also created a canteen especially for the employees. And this was the very first canteen for employees in the fashion industry.
So quite a pioneer in terms of her working methods. She was made a Knight of the Legion of Honour in 1926, so one of France's biggest accolades for her services to fashion. But she closed her shop and she died in Nice in 1962. What went wrong? Why did she disappear from public life?
One major fact is that she was married to Achille Sacerdote, who was Jewish, and because of World War II, they had very, very big problems. In 1941, they got divorced because Achille loved her so much and he wanted to save her, but it wasn't enough. So she went to Nice to escape, and in 1941, she published a false death certificate. And after World War II, she tried to come back with her assistant and associé, but they had different ways of thinking. So finally, she closed her house in 1948. And also, she died childless.
There was nobody to really carry on either her legacy or keep her name up there.
Yes.
But in a way, you've picked up the flame.
Yes, the curators in the fashion industry, the historians know her name, but nobody wrote about her. She had the Légion d'honneur because during World War I, she didn't dismiss anybody. And she also represented France all over the world. She was the trailblazer of France. During World War II, she was also really patriotic and she was more defending rights than collaborating.
So Anne Vogt there with a subtle reference to the checkered history of Coco Chanel, whose collaboration with the Nazi occupiers during World War II enabled her to weather the storm far better than Jenny did.
Avec Jeanne. Avec Jeanne.
So we've come to the end of the show. This episode was mixed by Cécile Pompiani.
Spotlight on France is a production of Radio France International. You can write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr. We'd love to hear from you if you have questions about the show, questions about France, or just to say hello.
You can find us on Instagram at Spotlight on France. And if you like the show, please consider rating us or even reviewing us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen.
We'll be back in 2 weeks on Thursday, July 4th. Bye, Alison.
Bye-bye, Sarah.